They knew exactly what they're doing.
Jewel thieves on a mission.
They went straight for the most expensive stuff.
The smash and grab caught on camera, and how it's not the first time the family business has been targeted.
Lucky to be alive.
You look at it and just wonder, how does anybody survive that?
A man who survived a life-altering crash talks about his road to recovery.
And seniors struggling in poverty.
It's been shocking, and it's been demoralizing. It's been stressful.
One of many in an aging population wrestling with a brutal financial reality and hoping for more support.
You're watching Global BC. This is Global News Hour at 6.
In and out in 120 seconds. Four thieves ransack a jewelry store, making off with tens of thousands of dollars in merchandise.
Good evening and thanks very much for joining us. That violent break-in at Semiahmoo Mall has devastated White Rock Jewelers and the family who runs it.
As Troy Charles reports, the business was uninsured and the loss is crippling.
It took less than 2 minutes for four mass thieves to make off with more than $100,000 in merchandise. It happened just after 4 a.m. Monday morning at White Rock Jewelers inside Semiahmoo Mall. Owner Kong Nguyen details the destruction.
They mark that one, they mark this one, they mark this one. You've broken here with the window here. Yeah, all the socket is marked.
First, the robbers broke a glass door at the mall entrance. Then they cut the lock on the jewelry store's security gate.
They knew exactly what they're doing. Then they slide open here.
Nguyen says they went straight for the expensive showcases, taking gold pendants, chains, and earrings.
They gained access. They had a plan, it would appear. They executed that plan and then departed.
Nguyen's son, Andy, recalls waking up to the frightening news.
All I hear is just like banging on the door at 5 a.m. and my mom's voice through the door. She's like, Andy, our store just got broken into. Like, we need to go now.
The family has owned the business for more than 10 years. Nguyen and his wife are shaken.
Right now, we feel unsafe.
Yeah. Hopefully they can catch them.
Yeah.
Just to have the words come out of her mouth that she doesn't feel safe and she's scared, that's like, it's really heartbreaking.
The store is not insured. Nguyen says in the past they tried three different insurance companies, but they wouldn't cover an older shop with older showcases. Even with the lost inventory and repair costs, the family says the store is staying open for now.
It almost means everything, I think, because that's all that my parents have.
We try the best. We try the best. We love the job.
Troy Charles, Global News.
A man who killed a senior inside a Nanaimo coffee shop in 2022 has been found not criminally responsible. James Turok was charged with second-degree murder after 79-year-old Eric Kutzner was stabbed to death inside the Buzz Coffee House. A BC Supreme Court judge has found Turok incapable of discerning right from wrong. On Tuesday, a forensic psychiatrist testified Turok suffers from a chronic and persistent mental disorder. When police arrested Turok, he reportedly referred to the victim as a zombie, but he could not recall that in subsequent interviews.
The man who survived a horrendous crash in Victoria last week that was caught on video is home from the hospital tonight and facing a long recovery. But as Kylie Stanton reports, he's thankful just to be alive.
Almost every night, this is no issue.
It's a drive he's done too many times to count.
Wait for the light, go through.
But last Wednesday night, things went horribly wrong.
I had a green light, and I got smoked by someone.
David Bruin was on his way home from teaching a jiu-jitsu class when he was T-boned by a driver running a red light.
There's me coming through. There's the other guy. Spin around. Everything blows up.
The impact sending his truck bed into a waiting bus.
The back of my truck just atomized. It was pretty incredible to watch.
But what may be even more incredible is Bruin is here to tell the story.
You look at it and just wonder, how does anybody survive that?
The crash left the 34-year-old with fractures in his neck and C1 vertebrae, organ bleeds, and a major concussion.
Every day is a little better. I'm lucky that I came into the accident in great shape. I definitely credit jiu-jitsu for keeping my head attached to my body. You get a thick neck from that.
This is the club. This is David's second home.
Bruin has become a big part of the community here at Van Isle Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, training, teaching, and mentoring the next generation. Now they're doing what they can to give back, raising more than $16,000 and counting.
It says to me that he is a very significant member of ours, and he's probably going to need that, anything to help him with his recovery, you know, help support himself because he's not going to be able to work.
Must be quite overwhelming, I imagine.
Yeah, but in a good way, I think.
Victoria police confirm they are still investigating what happened, but don't have any additional information to share at this time.
It should be that corner.
Bruin is just hopeful something will be done to address what he says is a known problem spot.
If something bad like this happens and we all get lucky, we shouldn't assume that the next person's going to get lucky.
Still already up and walking, Bruin has no plan on wasting his good fortune. That blind corner has somehow allowed him to see things more clearly than ever.
Does it make sense? No, but here I am.
Kylie Stanton, Global News.
Health Minister Adrian Dix promises changes are coming to healthcare in Prince Rupert. The hospital there had its 8th ER closure this month. Dix spent part of the week in the city, and as Kristen Robinson reports, he agrees the shortfalls are unacceptable.
It's a familiar notice for Prince Rupert residents. Due to challenges with physician coverage, the emergency department will be unavailable at the regional hospital. The latest service gap between 8 to 4 p.m. Wednesday.
It's scary for us every time it closes. I never know when we're going to need help.
The ER also closed when Tish Lozier's husband suffered multiple epileptic seizures last week, unleashing a healthcare nightmare which saw Joe Budnisky wait an hour and a half for urgent care and then fall and injure himself once he was sent home.
Joe's hanging in there. He's getting a little better every day.
Wednesday's ER closure is the 8th in Prince Rupert this month and comes a day after BC's health minister visited the community, meeting with doctors, nurses, paramedics, and city council on solutions to ER staffing issues.
My impression was that he was very committed to moving the needle.
Adrian Dix says Prince Rupert's problems stem from recent physician retirements, spring break, and changing circumstances around staffing the ER and the way family doctors are paid to ensure coverage. But he's committed to strengthening staffing and recruiting to fill vacancies.
We want to make sure that we have a permanent solution as well as dealing with the current situation and ending it so that people feel confidence that their ER will be open every day, as it should be and as it will be.
I would like it solved right now. It's not going to be that quick.
During ER closures, the nearest hospital is in Terrace, almost 2 hours and 146 kilometers away. Prince Rupert hosts the third largest port in Canada, and as it expands, the city's economy depends on healthcare resources to attract the workforce.
Our relationship with the port makes it even more visibly important that the services that the port requires to do its work are available in this community.
A community concerned about the future of 24/7 ER coverage.
They may not require the services, but if they do, they're just not going to be there.
Lozier has started a GoFundMe to help set up a fall alert system so Budnisky is safe when home alone. Kristen Robinson, Global News.
A BC senior is sharing her story of poverty and how she faces the very real threat of becoming homeless.
As Alyssa Thibault reports, like many seniors, Deborah Buxton is facing an impossible choice, a roof over her head or her health.
You know, this is what I look like now, and this is what I looked like just a couple of years ago before I became homeless.
Once happy and vibrant, now Deborah Buxton says she's seeing the physical impacts of poverty.
I had a beautiful smile.
The 72-year-old can hardly afford to feed herself, and at the end of next month, she's losing her home.
Every day I say, maybe I should just kill myself. I'm not of use anymore. Why am I here? And then I have to talk myself out of it.
Buxton lives in supportive housing in North Vancouver, but the site is being redeveloped, and Buxton is now facing the very real possibility of living in a tent.
I've just been praying that to get and doing what I can to try to attract a vehicle, because at least if you got a vehicle, you can sleep, you're mobile, and you're warm and safe.
During her career, Buxton worked as an NDP organizer and a negotiator for unions.
I never worried about money. I was able to live my passion and just be of service.
But within a 10-year time frame, she lost two husbands to cancer and her father died. She was making extra money by driving children to after-school activities. Then her vehicle broke down.
Well, when I lost my car, I lost all that little bit of extra help, and that I just nosedived into not being able to survive, never mind thrive anymore.
Every month, she has to make choices between buying health supplements or paying rent.
You know, my life is at stake here.
Tuesday afternoon, Buxton told her story to the public safety minister as part of an affordability roundtable, speaking out for others in situations like hers.
I just felt like it's so necessary for somebody like myself. At least I can articulate my situation.
Seniors advocates say pensions and government supports are not keeping up with the increased cost of living, and many living in their golden years are finding it's anything but.
And it's been shocking, and it's been demoralizing, it's been stressful, and
Alyssa Thibault, Global News.
Global News asked BC Housing for a response to Deborah Buxton's story, but as of our deadline, we've heard nothing back.
Well, get ready to pay more for public transit in BC starting July 1st. TransLink says it's facing increasing ridership and a financial crisis. And as Catherine Urquhart reports, it won't be just riders on the hook.
You'll soon be paying more to use public transit in Metro Vancouver. About 5 to 10 cents more for an average trip.
Everything's going up, so whoever's running the bus is going to have to be paying more.
It's a little bit stiff. I know everything's gone up, but still.
That will be too much expensive for me because I have college.
It's definitely something we're going to tackle.
A 2024 investment plan presented this month to the Metro Vancouver Regional District Board proposes fare increases of 2.3% this year, an increase that was approved in 2022, then 4% in 2025 and 3% in 2026.
TransLink is facing a structural deficit due to lower than projected fare revenues, declining fuel tax revenues, and increased costs due to inflation.
TransLink is also suggesting a one-time bump to Metro Vancouver property taxes this year of $80 million, about $37 more for the median property owner.
I think we can all agree that what we need is a transit system that works, that people can rely on, you don't have to get passed up by the bus if you're waiting for it out in Surrey. There aren't long lineups. So you can get to work, you can get to school, and you can get to your medical appointments. And, you know, we have been very transparent about our financial situation and the deficit we are facing.
TransLink says it's accepting online feedback about the increases until April 5th. And this is not part of a long-term plan.
It's just a short-term plan to address the critical problems that we're seeing in the system right now. And we anticipate we'll have to do another investment plan to look at the long-term solutions in 2025.
Increases are intended to cover a number of service increases, as well as a $4.7 billion funding gap. They're due to take effect in July. Catherine Urquhart, Global News.
The Prime Minister is promising new legislation to help renters across Canada.
Justin Trudeau in Vancouver this morning announcing the Renters' Bill of Rights, one of three new measures to be included in the upcoming federal budget. The bill would require landlords to disclose their property's rental price history to prospective tenants. And Trudeau says your rent payment history could help you qualify for a mortgage.
That payment and that demonstrated reliability that you've shown over months and years is taken into account when you apply for a mortgage. We're going to amend the Canadian Mortgage Charter and call on landlords, banks, credit bureaus, and others to make sure that your rental history is taken into account in your credit score. This will make it easier to qualify for a mortgage or even qualify you at a lower rate.
The Bill of Rights would also include a legal aid fund to protect renters against bad landlords.
And the province is clarifying some of its rules around short-term rentals in complexes that operate as strata hotels and motels. Keith Baldry is live with more on this. Keith, there's been a lot of concern around these new rules, so let's clear it up.
Yeah, so when we first reported Ravi Kale on the housing minister's bills back in November, we pointed out the devil was going to be in the details. In this case, the regulations that accompany the legislation. And that's exactly what we got today, answering the concerns of a delegation of vacation rental owners from Parksville who attended the legislature a couple weeks ago to make their case that they're a unique situation. They should be exempt from the ban on short-term rentals. Today, Housing Minister Ravi Kale announcing exactly what happened. Looks like a little bit of lobbying, a little pressure paid off for the people in Parksville, also other communities that the minister mentions. Here's Ravi Kale.
Well, I believe it solves the issues that certainly the mayor of Parksville raised with me, the mayors of Vernon and Kelowna. They've got strata hotels, and they will now continue to operate in the communities to support the tourism. But again, the rest of the housing that we desperately need will come back and be available for renters in our communities.
Now, there's a couple of qualifications they have to meet here. First of all, they have to have a dedicated person, an attendant at the front desk for check-in purposes and provide housekeeping services as well, or be prevented from offering long-term rental because of zoning restrictions or restriction covenants. But nevertheless, I think the people of Parksville made their case quite successful. And I anticipate we're going to see more regulations, Chris, as this bill takes form and we see real-life experiences that may have some unanticipated consequences. So look for more clarification to come with this landmark housing legislation introduced last fall.
No doubt. I know there are some properties in Kelowna that have similar issues. Yeah. Thanks for that, Keith.
Well, it's only March, but BC's wildfire season has already begun.
It's been shocking to us to have new wildfires actually ignited and BC Wildfire having to put them out in February.
How last year's season never really ended and why some say we need to flip the script on how we deal with fires. Next on the NewsHour.
No one else is going to help you. It's just you against that.
A special set of skills and more than 50 hours without sleep that helped this BC man win what some consider the world's toughest test of human endurance. Coming up later.
Also tonight, the controversy that's making it hard to rest in peace at this Vernon Cemetery. That's still to come tonight.
Right now, though, it is a shockingly early start to the wildfire season in BC, and it's predicted to get worse.
As Cassidy Moscone reports, experts say BC needs to spend a lot more now to mitigate the risk before things really heat up.
BC's 2024 wildfire season is here.
It's been shocking to us to have new wildfires actually ignited and BC Wildfire having to put them out in February.
That's according to UBC researchers who say in a lot of ways, last year's record-breaking, devastating season didn't really end.
We still have those zombie fires, those holdover fires where they had so much fire last summer. Over 90 fires are still burning in the Northeast, carried over from the 2023 fire season.
2.8 million hectares burnt, more than double the size of any previous year. The outlook for this season?
Not much has changed. We have been in drought conditions all through this fall and winter and early spring, and the low snowpacks this winter mean that much of British Columbia is at high risk of fire right now.
It might dampen your long weekend plans, but experts say the one thing we all need to be hoping for is rain. We need our landscapes and forests saturated this spring to make an impact on this prolonged drought.
The thing that can make the biggest difference
is investing in proactive management. And frankly, we're not investing enough there. We appreciate the extra $30 million that were in the budget this year, but we need hundreds of millions to billions of dollars. In the last 20 years, we've spent $6 billion on fire suppression, but we've only spent less than $500 million in British Columbia over 20 years to do the proactive work to make our community safer and the ecosystems more resilient.
No one from BC Wildfire Service or the Forests Minister was available to speak to us on camera Wednesday. In a written statement, the Minister told Global News there is no doubt that more work needs to be done. He said a number of changes and improvements had already been made, including almost tripling the number of prescribed burns this year. Cassidy Moscone, Global News.
North Vancouver RCMP are issuing a public warning after two suspicious fires.
Police say the fires were set in the Norgate area on Tuesday. In one case, a passerby called 911 after seeing hedges burning in the 1300 block of Soden Street. Another call came from a homeowner on the same block who found his 10-foot hedges fully engulfed.
Oh, it was dangerous enough. If it went further, it could have got to my neighbor's truck right at the end of the hedge there. Or who knows, is how dangerous is fire.
The fire season, the wildfire season is rapidly approaching. To take extra precautions, and obviously we're, you know, in these two incidents are quite alarming. You know, if had this been summer and a little more dry, it could have had a catastrophic outcome.
Police say in both cases, witnesses reported seeing three 10 to 12-year-old boys loitering in the area just prior to the fires being set.
New developments at the Baltimore Bridge collapse. Success for the underwater specialists trying to recover the bodies of missing victims.
Also coming up, the anniversary of one of BC's worst natural disasters. 60 years since the Port Alberni tsunami. Divers have now recovered the bodies of two of six construction workers presumed dead following that bridge collapse in Baltimore.
Meanwhile, investigators are reviewing the ship's voyage data recorder, hoping to create a timeline of what led up to the disaster.
A tragic discovery in the river behind me. Officials say divers recovered the bodies of two of the six missing construction crew members who were working on the bridge when it collapsed here in Baltimore, Maryland. The two men, aged 26 and 35, were found in a red truck submerged in about 7.5 meters of water. And after 2 days of hard work, officials say their recovery effort turns to a salvage operation.
Faced with an underwater obstacle course, divers work below the water's surface as a search and rescue effort transitioned into a recovery operation.
They are in frigid conditions. They are down there in darkness where they can literally see about a foot in front of them. They are trying to navigate mangled metal.
The mission? To recover the bodies of the construction workers presumed dead. Miguel Luna is one of them. An immigrant support group says he was from El Salvador, a father who had lived in Maryland for 19 years.
It's tough.
Angelo Solero runs a Latino cultural organization in Baltimore.
You know, you come to America, you know, trying to raise your family, trying to reach the American dream, and you lose your life.
Two Mexican nationals, two people originally from Guatemala, and one Honduran are also confirmed to be among the dead. Solero says their loss will be felt by the entire community.
Those are human beings who were working on that bridge to keep that bridge going. And because of this tragedy, they lost their lives.
As the scope of the tragedy becomes clearer, questions remain over what led up to the collision and quick collapse. The vessel's voyage data recorder is now in the hands of investigators. It's like an airplane's black box and is being analyzed. Search crews had more items on their list when they boarded the ship Wednesday.
We will be looking for any sort of electronics, documentation. We will want to take pictures. We will want to look at the engine room of the vessel, the bridge.
Officials say they believe there are still other vehicles encased in concrete and pieces of the bridge in the river behind me, but stress it is simply too dangerous for divers to continue the recovery operation. Joel Senek, Global News, near Baltimore, Maryland.
Marine traffic in and around the port of Baltimore is at a standstill following that collapse. The ripple effect of the tragedy means delays and disruptions to shipping, especially in the auto industry. Anne Gaviola has more on the impact.
It's a huge economic impact for the country. This port is responsible for over 51 million tons of foreign cargo.
Before this tragedy struck, Baltimore's port was the ninth busiest in the U.S., handling the greatest volume of car and truck shipments. If you've purchased or are thinking of purchasing a high-end vehicle made in Europe or Asia, analysts say you can expect delays, less selection for certain features, and ultimately higher prices. Industry expert Flavio Volpe says this situation is as disruptive, though shorter, than the microchip shortage during the pandemic years.
It's akin to one major ramp or intersection at on the 401 being closed. Yes, you can find your way home or you can find your way to work, but likely what will happen is it's going to clog all the other arteries.
Vehicles and other shipments held up in and around Maryland will have to find their way through the ports of Halifax, Montreal, or even Vancouver. Other goods impacted will include coal, sugar, and farm equipment. This supply chain analyst says the timing of the disruption isn't good for farmers who depend on heavy equipment like tractors.
So unfortunately, we are seeing planting season approaching here in the United States, especially for corn that'll be going into the ground heavily in April.
Economically, the greatest impact will be on Maryland's local economy. Though the bridge collapse isn't expected to have a major impact on international shipping, the worry is that the cumulative effect of this port shutdown, plus pressure from attacks by Houthi militants on the Red Sea and a drought in Panama that has snarled traffic in the Panama Canal, all add up. Anne Gaviola, Global News, Toronto.
Coming up, a Vernon cemetery sparks a human rights complaint. A man on a mission to change the rules and why he won't let it rest.
Also, increasing measles cases and what's driving the outbreaks in Canada.
Controversy over new restrictions at an Okanagan cemetery, where loved ones will now only be allowed to leave fresh-cut floral arrangements in approved tribute holders.
That isn't sitting well with everyone, and as Jaden Wozni reports, some feel the bylaw goes against human and religious rights.
Vernon resident Joe Langlois says he comes to the Pleasant Valley Cemetery every so often to pay respects to his friends. But a bylaw that recently came into effect bans anyone from leaving non-floral items on plots during the spring, summer, and part of fall, and he says that violates his human and religious rights.
There's a small group of us that totally disagree with Section 5.5 and 5.6. which restricts religious articles like rosaries and pictures and religious practices. It contradicts any standard of celebrating somebody's life.
In an interview with Global News earlier this month, Vernon's mayor says the bylaw was created simply to protect the cemetery staff as well as the public.
Council made this decision a number of years ago. He introduced it slowly, lots of warning to people so they knew. And for most of the folks that we've interacted with, it's been a great positive step forward.
Last March, Langlois created a petition to try and get the city to reverse their decision, but now he's taking things a step further. He says he's filed a human rights complaint against the city.
It was online with the province of BC, and it's still being investigated. And I've also approached one firm, which they're very interested in pursuing it.
Global News reached out to the BC Human Rights Tribunal. Typically, it takes 1 to 2 months for the tribunal to decide if it can deal with a complaint, but due to a high volume of complaints, it says it could take 9 to 12 months to provide an update on cases recently filed. In a statement to Global News, the city of Vernon says through the media, the city has been informed of a potential complaint filed to the Human Rights Tribunal regarding Cemetery Management Bylaw number 5767. However, at present, the city is unaware of any official complaints filed with the Human Rights Tribunal. As this matter could potentially be under review by the Human Rights Tribunal, it would be inappropriate for the city to comment. The bylaw is in effect from March 15th to October 15th. The city says any items placed at an interment site that are not accepted will be respectfully removed. Jaden Wozni, Global News, Vernon.
Canada is facing a rising number of measles cases, and there are concerns of more outbreaks. There have been 40 cases reported so far this year. That's three times higher than 2023. Seven of those cases have required hospital care. The majority of the affected have been unvaccinated children. But as Catherine Ward reports, despite the disease being largely preventable thanks to vaccines, new polling shows not everyone is willing to roll up their sleeves.
When you stack up how people feel about measles, COVID-19, and influenza, measles is perceived as the most dangerous out of the three.
That perceived severity is not necessarily translating into a consensus on vaccinations.
83% of Canadians view the measles vaccine as safe. 80% say the same for the flu. But only 71% of people think the same for the COVID-19 vaccine, according to polling done by Ipsos for Global News. Canada's chief public health officer says the majority of the recent measles cases reported in Canada are in people who are not vaccinated against the disease. And Dr. Theresa Tam says a risk assessment found it is possible infections from international travel could cause outbreaks in childcare and preschool centers, healthcare facilities, and the wider community. Ipsos Senior Vice President Sean Simpson says there are strong opinions on whether vaccines should be mandatory for children, with the dividing line being a person's age.
If you're 55 or older, around 7 in 10 believe that that measles vaccine should be mandatory. And if you're under 55, it's only about half who believe that the measles vaccine should be mandatory, even if parents object to it. So 50% is obviously not a majority, not close to approaching consensus, and actually means that it is becoming quite a divisive issue in this country.
Furthermore, roughly a third of Canadians say they don't think people need vaccines to build immunity. And perhaps not surprisingly, the data shows nearly a quarter of people don't even want to bring up the touchy topic of vaccines with friends and family.
Health Minister Mark Holland acknowledges vaccine hesitancy is a challenge and wants to see politics taken out of health information.
There's a lot of different views, but there are some places we shouldn't cross swords. And when we do, we confuse people. It's so unfortunate and tragic watching people get so sick when it's totally preventable.
Catherine Ward, Global News, Toronto.
Still ahead, a BC ultra marathoner takes on the legendary Barkley Marathons.
Everything you imagine you hear is truth. It's as terrifying as you can picture it in your head.
What it took to win the grueling 160-kilometer slog through some of the roughest backcountry in America. Later.
Also, the 60th anniversary of the Port Alberni tsunami, the damage and how it could have been so much worse. Today marks the 60th anniversary of one of the most destructive tsunamis ever to hit BC.
On March 27, 1964, three huge waves hit Port Alberni in the middle of the night. The 27th was Good Friday that year, and most people were still in bed. The waves, the largest one, 5 meters high, were triggered by a deadly 9.2 earthquake in Alaska. More than 50 homes and businesses were destroyed. Luckily, most people were able to evacuate before the most destructive second wave, and there were no deaths or even serious injuries. The earthquake and tsunami led to the development of the West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center, which issues real-time tsunami notifications to areas of potential impact.
What a reminder that that can happen on our coast. Okay, let's bring in Yvonne Schell right now for a look ahead to the weather forecast.
Yeah, it's been beautiful. A few breaks out there, depending on where you are. We actually got a few photos that were captured, double rainbows. This one captured in Walnut Grove, so thank you so much, Linda. Another one from Walnut Grove, this one taken by Kate. There's a double rainbow in there. And this one, great shot from Maple Ridge, so thank you for sending in those great photos. Here's what it looks like from the Pan Pacific Hotel. We've got temperatures sitting at 10 degrees. Could still be a bit breezy this evening, and there is still some instability. We are tracking the potential, especially eastern areas, extending into the Fraser Valley with a wave of heavier rain and a slight risk of a thunderstorm this evening before it really does start to ease off. Now, we are going to still see that instability and behind it for tomorrow in the wake of the system. And we are also looking at some snow if you're traveling along the mountain passes. Sea to sky with up to 2 centimeters, but it's the Kootenay Pass with anywhere between 5 and 10, and then an additional 2 and 4 centimeters for tomorrow. Now, the northern half of the province will see a nice break. A clearing is on the way. Temperatures up to 12 degrees. Areas near the Peace with a few flurries in the mix. Areas across the central interior will see more of a clearing through the afternoon. Southern half of the province, we've got the risk of thunderstorms for the Columbia and Kootenay region and all areas across the island as well as the lower mainland. It is going to still be a mainly cloudy sky. We will see the potential for a few showers that'll be in the mix. Our 5-day forecast, so a bit breezy for tomorrow. Chance for some showers. A chance of showers will be for Friday morning. A clearing will be on the way, and then just in time for Saturday and Sunday for the Easter egg hunt, it'll be dry and sunny with temperatures up to 14 degrees. All right, tonight's weather window, a great shot. Mountain bluebird. This one captured in Clinton from Amanda.
Oh, blends
in. We're trying to figure out what that was.
It blends in with the sky.
Sure does.
All right, Squire is here now with a look ahead to sports.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For helping me out with my wardrobe, too.
Yeah, from the corner of my eye, I just saw that there was some sort of wardrobe.
The collar and soapy came through in the clutch. Okay, so there was a lot of worry when the Vancouver Canucks said this morning Thatcher Demko is going on long-term injury. But Rick Tocchet says, don't worry about that.
That's just cap for cap related. So you get some cap relief. So that's all it is.
Yeah, it basically means the Canucks can bring somebody up, and it's going to be Arshdeep Bains. Of course, he played 5 games for Vancouver back in February before going back to the minors, but now he's coming back to the NHL.
Also tonight, the first Canadian ever to cross the finish line at the Barkley Marathons, and why the feat is so impressive. Okay, so we shouldn't freak out.
Don't freak out.
No.
Hey. Well, at least that's what they're telling
us. Don't panic.
Don't panic. It's like Kevin Bacon in Animal House when the everything's going wrong.
Don't
remain
freak
calm.
Out.
Okay, the Vancouver Canucks have retroactively, it's a lot of syllables in that word, put Thatcher Demko on long-term injured reserve, which, as we said, don't freak out, doesn't necessarily mean his knee injury or lower body injury is worse than first thought. This move does mean two things. One, Demko cannot return to the Canucks until April 6th against the LA Kings at the earliest. And two, Vancouver now has room on the roster to recall Arshdeep Bains from Abbotsford. It basically is being done so the Caps have some cap space to call up Bains from the minors. And that, this thing just keeps going and going. Anyway, here's what Rick Tocchet had to say.
Well, we get some cap space to bring a couple of guys up. I think it's important to have, to see where he's at, maybe throw him in the lab. I'm not sure if he's going to play tomorrow or not, but, it's competition. He went down there. He's kind of did a couple of things that we like, and he's got some speed.
Is that a sign he'll be here for the rest of the year?
No, not necessarily. I wouldn't say. There's 10 games left. I couldn't say that, no.
Okay, so Dakota Joshua is close to coming back. The Canucks have really missed him since he got hurt when he hurt his hand in a fight with Chicago's Mackenzie Entwistle. It's kind of been forgotten. In that game, he actually had 3 points before the fight. Now, he's been working out. He's ready to go. But Rick Tocchet is not sure if he's quite ready to play against Dallas tomorrow. But he knows they need him back soon.
Well, I think, when you look at that L.A. game, that's where Dakota's, he's that guy that can, get that puck around the net. And obviously the way he's, over the last year, how he's gotten better and better.
In sports, you never want to make your guests feel welcome. They have to fear your place, like it's the Overlook Hotel in Shining. Let them in and then make them uncomfortable. But the Vancouver Whitecaps have been the opposite so far this season. In their two home games, they've given their opponents too much room and too much respect. If they hadn't, they'd probably still be unbeaten. So things better change for Saturday's home game against Portland.
Attendance is up. An average of 26,000 were at BC Place for the first two home games of the MLS season.
Yeah, I think it gives us confidence. The fact that, the numbers have shot up in the last couple of years, it kind of shows to us that we're doing a good job, we're improving.
Unfortunately, the fans were forced to watch two poor performances by the Whitecaps.
I think at home, especially when we have like 20,000 people with us, we have to be more aggressive. We have to force other team to make some mistakes, to even create more chances, to even include them more into game. So it's better for us.
The Caps did get the home crowd on their side when they took a 1-0 first half lead against Real Salt Lake last weekend, but were outplayed in the second half and let the lead slip away, falling 2-1 to suffer their first loss of the season.
We normally pride ourselves on being hard to break down, hard to create chances against, but it wasn't like that on Saturday. So yeah, a bit of work needed done on the defensive side, and just trying to raise the energy. I feel like it was a little bit flat from us on Saturday.
Vancouver will get a boost from three key pieces that were missing in that home loss against RSL. Andres Kubas and Fafa Pico were playing with their national teams, and coach Vanni Sertini was serving the final game of his suspension.
It's always a matter of, feeling a little bit helpless, like last game. You're upstairs and things are starting to go not in the right direction. We didn't play very well the second half, and you feel a little bit, helpless.
Yeah, obviously having Vanny back will bring that extra energy, and I'm sure it'll bring energy to the fans as well.
So we go out today, we kill them, we destroy them, we win, and we go to the final!
happy that finally we'll be able to, you know, help the team even on game day. Doesn't change anything of what we've done so far in the week, but, you know, for sure on Saturday it will be different kind of emotion than the last 4 weeks, for sure.
The Whitecaps have the next three games at home, so we'll see if the attendance numbers climb or start to slide based off their performances. Asa Raymond, Global Sports.
And Major League Baseball starts for real tomorrow. Jays, Rays in Tampa Bay. That's all I have for today.
Okay. Opening day. Hip, hip, hooray.
Thank you.
A BC runner just did something only 19 others have ever done. And he had to stay awake 56 hours to do it. That's coming up next.
Jordan Armstrong is here now with a look ahead to Global News at 11. Jordan?
Sophie, we're hearing tonight from the brother of Eric Kutzner now that the man who killed the senior in a Nanaimo coffee shop has been found not criminally responsible. Plus, a bizarre day at Kamloops City Hall. It started with the mayor announcing unexpectedly that he was suspending the city's top employee. Then city council turned around and delivered a rebuke of the mayor. We'll sort it out, all out, or at least try to, tonight on Global News at 11. Sophie?
Like a reality TV show up there.
Sure is.
Thank you, Jordan.
Never a dull moment. Okay, the Barkley Marathons is considered so grueling, so physically punishing, that there are no winners, only finishers, because the course always wins.
Ihor Verries of Chilliwack is one of only 20 people and the first Canadian ever to finish the race. Not only that, he conquered it and all the other participants on his very first attempt. John Hua reports.
To say Ihor Verris
speed go 12 and a half
quickly goes through trail runners is a bit of an understatement. The 29-year-old from Chilliwack might have worn out his last few pairs, running in the most infamous and challenging ultramarathon in the world.
Everything you imagine you hear is truth. It's as terrifying as you can picture it in your head.
The Barkley Marathons in Frozen Head State Park in Tennessee pushes participants so hard, they're sent condolence letters instead of invites.
I was like, oh my gosh, I'm in Barkley. But then I was like, oh my gosh, I'm in Barkley. I'm screwed.
To put it in perspective, the distance is equivalent to running from Garrison's Running Company in Chilliwack all the way to Squamish. The elevation climbing Mount Everest from sea level twice. Hazardous terrain, no trail markers. Oh, you also have to finish it within 60 hours.
You cannot turn off your brain, not for a second, because if you do so, you'll be lost and the course will eat you.
Since the first race in 1986, Barclays has feasted on plenty. Only 20 runners have finished it to date.
It's gnarly. It's sinister even. Like, it's just absolutely wild.
You're walking well, though.
But those who've supported Verris over his very short 4 years of competitive trail running knew this grueling ultra marathon had met its match.
Lots of people do not make that race, but I just couldn't see him failing at it.
His busted fingers clawed his way up through the mud. Briar thorns cut up his legs and neck.
My legs were so cut up that I had blood rushing into my shoes.
All of the pain, training, and effort scoring Verris the ultimate hat trick. First attempt, his first finish, and first place.
Probably will take years to sink in. It all seems like a dream.
Verris credits the community's support for pushing him forward, relishing his wounds as reminders it was all real. The question now, would he do it again?
Well, a true Barker will never tell you that.
John Hua, Global News.
And more history at this year's Barkley Marathons with the race's first ever female finisher. British ultra runner Jasmine Paris reached the gate just 99 seconds before that 60-hour cutoff. The 40-year-old veterinarian only slept 3 minutes the entire 2.5 days, saying later that what got her to the finish line was believing in herself, and this was her third attempt.
You just see the complete exhaustion. The record holder's done it four times.
Yeah, that's incredible. And remember Gary Robbins, another local runner, almost finished it a couple of times. But it's not so much the physical, because these guys are all in great shape, and women. Mm-hmm. It's up here, because you're up for so much.
That's right.
Good for him.
All right.
And her.
And her, exactly. Thanks for watching, everyone. Hope you have a great night.
Good night, all.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.